Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. This is podcast number 86 for January 23rd, 2012, and it's Monday. This will be, I believe, the first real podcast that I've done in, I think about a week or so. I've been down with the flu. My wife also had the flu. Fortunately, Kai is not with us today, but Kai was able to escape having the flu by not being around any of us. But it hit us pretty hard. So I appreciate your patience listening to a bunch of reruns and past episodes and the other things that I put up. I also stole a couple of, actually I should clarify the difference. I stole an article from Anthony Gregory that's on intellectual property, and it was really good. I posted that at badquaker.com on the 19th. I can't remember. I think that was maybe Friday, if I recall, Thursday or Friday. And then prior to that, Bob Higgs was kind enough to provide me with an article to post on what is the point of my libertarian anarchism. And that's just a wonderful article. And I really appreciate Bob Higgs letting me post that for him. He is such a kind individual anyway. And he's a man who has spent his life living the life that he talks about, not just giving it lip service. He is the real deal. When I spoke with him, I should probably bring up his interview as a rerun at some point in the near future, just so that people get to hear it again. But when I spoke to him last year, he was just the nicest man that you'd ever want to encounter. I can't say enough good about Bob Higgs, and for him to be so kind as to allow me to publish this article for him, it was a great honor to not only me but all of us here at BadQuaker.com. So thanks, Bob. I appreciate that. And speaking of Bob, his wife also, I did a interview with his wife, Elizabeth, last year as well. And that was, I really enjoyed that interview. Maybe I'll bring that one up as a rerun the next time I'm sick or something like that. Okay, so, and yes, I am back in the Bad Quaker studio, back in my office. My poor pepper plant is surviving the winter pretty good here in the office. It's got a good window access, so it's got plenty of light, and I have a double bucket watering system so that it can survive long periods of time with me gone, fortunately. One of these days, when I start doing YouTube videos, I'll show my bucket method to have to be able to garden in a 5-gallon bucket and have it not dry out really bad. I put a lot of couple years of on and off experimentation until I came up with the method that I've got for that. Of course, none of that has anything to do with my notes for today's podcasts. Podcast. I'm only doing one. English. Such a funny language. Okay, so I was getting in the habit of reading this statement from L. Neil Smith at the beginning of each podcast, and so I want to jump right back into that because I really think it's important, and I think it's important that this is coming from someone other than me, because when I say these things all the time, sometimes, you know, only hearing it from one source, kind of you kind of gloss over it after a while. So I want to continue to quote L. Neil Smith and others on this topic whenever possible. Okay, this is the non-aggression principle, quote by L. Neil Smith. A libertarian is a person who believes that no one has the right, under any circumstances, to initiate force against another human being or to advocate or delegate its initiation. Those who act consistently with this principle are libertarians, whether they realize it or not. Those who fail to act consistently with it are not libertarians, regardless of what they may claim. L. Neil Smith. And of course, if you're on Facebook, if you follow badquaker.com on Facebook, you'll know that when I've quoted L. Neil Smith on there, I usually refer to him as L. Neil, like like El Cid, and I hope I'm not violating my Quaker ethics by referring to him thusly. It's just more of a fun title than one of actual an honor title like Quakers generally shun. Now, I did want to mention something that I kind of took note of. In thinking of anarchy, you know, I've talked before about how the word anarchy has almost been twisted to the point of where you can't say it without negative connotations coming into the conversation. And I've made the argument in the past that when we surrender the meaning of a word like that, we're not really accomplishing anything, because whatever word we use to replace it with, the evil forces of the state, the media, the teachers, the public school teachers, all those negative aspects of the state, whatever word we choose to use to describe ourselves with, they'll just demonize that word. So, you know, we can use any particular phrase that we might be comfortable with, and they're going to demonize it. So, I'm comfortable using the phrase and the word anarchy and the phrase anarcho-capitalist, even though, like I've said before, anarchy gets a bad rap in the media, and capitalism gets bad rap in the media and in schools. Still, I mean, you can't just not use the words because other people lie about those words. So we're kind of stuck with it. But in reference to anarchy, I did want to mention the comparison of how children act naturally when there's essentially a non-regulated situation, how children naturally react according to the principles of anarchy. Especially in the area of play. When children are together and there is no supervision and they're just having fun, being kids, not harming anything, just out there, just doing their thing, it is, in its purest form, anarchy. And then I was thinking about, I was actually watching a football game the other day, and it struck me that the NFL... the National Football League, for all those folks that are listening that are not in the U.S., my reference here is to football as in the American football sense, not in what the rest of the world calls football. Talking about taking a word and using it in different ways. Anyway, so I'm talking about American football, or the NFL, the National Football League. The NFL has begun some time back investing a lot of money to get kids to play touch football. Now, for our foreign listeners, the difference between what we would call the NFL style football and touch football, you play with no pads, and there's essentially no tackling. You just run up, and either with one or both hands, you touch the person with the ball, and they're considered down. Sometimes we play flag football, and this is where you kind of hang one or more strips of material from your belt, and then to tackle the runner or the person with the ball, the other person has to just grab one of those flags and yank them off of the person's belt. These are variations of football that are much safer to play, and much you don't have to have a lot of equipment, a lot of protection and helmets and so forth. Well, the NFL in the last few years is putting more and more of an emphasis on getting kids to play and getting them to play specifically touch football. And some things dawned on me about this. A few years ago, the NFL discovered that it was essentially losing popularity with the younger kids in the U.S. Basketball and soccer, among other things, there were other sports too that were gaining very rapidly. Hockey was gaining very rapidly among American youths, but NFL-style football was really falling off, and it was even falling off on the high school support level. Not so much the parents were still supporting it and so forth, but there was less enthusiasm among the actual students in schools over their football teams and so forth. So the NFL very wisely realized that it needed to win the next generation back to a dedication to NFL football. Otherwise, you know, in a few years, their source of income is going to start drying up. So they began setting up these charities and encouraging players to invest their time and effort and money to support these charities that get kids, and they use all kinds of excuses. Oh, this is all about fitness. This is about health. This is about getting the kids off the couch and out doing something and away from the computer and away from the games, the, you know, computerized games and so forth. And this was the excuse that was given, but deep down inside, and I'm sure that many of the NFL players and many of the people in the NFL, I'm sure they were honest in their intent on this. But if you look past the curtain and you see what's really pulling the strings back there, the fact of the matter is the NFL was losing popularity with young kids, and there's a very easy reason why. When you look on television and you see a basketball game, you see a bunch of people running around in shorts and you know, a light shirt and shoes, and that's pretty much what you see them wearing. And they have a ball, and they have a floor, and they have a hoop, and that's pretty much the game. It's basketball is a very straightforward game. It is a high skill game, but it's also a game that if a bunch of people are together of near equal skill, even if they're not highly skilled, if they're a near and equal match, they can have a lot of fun playing basketball with very little investment. If you've got a flat spot, and if it's paved, that's even better, or if there's cement, or it's a hardwood floor, or whatever. If you've got a flat spot and a hoop and a ball, you can play basketball. Soccer is the same way. If you have an open space, preferably grassy, but any open space, you can kick around a soccer ball, and no matter, the skill level is not as important as that the peers and the peer level involved is similar, or that the children playing are on a peer level in their skills. That's more important than whether they are very skilled or not. And as these kids will interact and play, they'll get better and they'll get more enthusiastic about the particular sport that they're playing. So the NFL was going up against this as competition. More and more kids could just real easily grab a soccer ball and go out and kick it around and have fun. And if a second kid joined in, that's great. And if five kids joined in, that's great. You could just play soccer out in the yard or out in a field or out in the street. And the same way with basketball. You grab a basketball and you can literally play by yourself. You can have a lot of fun with a basketball by yourself. It's a little hard to do that with a football. So the NFL very wisely began reintroducing a generation of kids to touch football because they weren't seeing touch football on TV. They weren't seeing their so-called heroes playing touch football. So what do you have to do? Well, you have to get those famous NFL players to take off all those pads and all that expensive equipment and get out and have shots on TV of them playing with kids. And all of a sudden, NFL football starts to become more popular again. And now you have a sport where you have a couple kids, and you have a football, and you can draw a line on the ground, you can play. Now this is something that football did, this is something that the NFL did completely, they could have done completely outside of the realm of using the violence of the state. Unfortunately, you know, even something that simple is going to be polluted by the state because they set up these tax deductible organizations and they end up using tax supported funding for them, and they end up getting grants and they do these other things which are essentially theft. And you know, so and I'm not saying that setting up a charity and then getting a tax deduction for it is theft. I'm not saying that. We should, whenever possible, whenever anybody can avoid paying legally, avoid paying taxes. And I say legally because, of course, it's no fun to get thrown in jail. It's no fun to have the force of the state come down on you. It's more logical to obey the laws that you have to in order to, you know, stay as free as possible. So I don't blame anybody for setting up a charity and getting every tax advantage that they can get. But then when they start to end up actually getting free support, and when you know, network television are pressured to give them free advertising time and things like this, then they've utilized the state and the aggression of the state in an unfair manner. And that's unethical. That violates what we just talked about a second ago in the zero aggression principle, or the non-aggression principle. One other big difference between NFL-style football and what you might consider as flag football is also a huge difference between NFL football and street basketball or street soccer. That is that NFL football is the rules are extremely complicated, and all the playing positions are highly specialized. Well, when kids get together, that's not gonna float with them, because what they want is the ability for a bunch of kids without a coach and without without officials, without regulations, and without you know, adults interfering. They want to get a bunch of kids just get together and go out there and just play the game. They like that. That's where kids really excel. Now, a lot of parents are uncomfortable with that. They can't handle the idea of just letting kids take a ball and 15 or 20 of them go out there and just play. And they think that they need to have some kind of structure. They need to get them involved in some kind of organization where there's going to be coaches and where there's going to be, you know, referees with whistles, and they're going to demand this and demand that and follow all the rules and everything. But honestly, if you just take a ball and hand it to kids and just let them go and do their own thing, the level of enjoyment that they're going to have in sorting the problem out and getting the game going, they'll go out there and play for hours if you let them, if you just leave them alone and let them do that. That's anarchy. And the difference in that is what you see in the NFL. Of course, there's all these complicated rules, and there's every position is specialized. Every play is extremely complicated. You don't see that in any natural manifestation of kids playing. And yet, those kids out there, whether they're playing basketball or touch football or street soccer, when you watch the kids, natural leaders develop, natural positions in the game develop, and the kids have a lot more fun. It's not, and some people will get all picky about this, about they think that the problem with organized sports is the winning part and the losing part. But no, you're getting that all wrong. The part that is the problem with organized sports, whether it's on any level really, but especially with kids, the problem with organized sports is that you are in essence killing the very spirit of play. You're killing what it is that makes it the most fun for kids, and it becomes work and dedication and team spirit and all those things that are actually just teaching the kid how to be a slave of the state. So child's play is anarchy, and anarchy is child's play. But when you bring the coach in, and you bring in the whistles, and you bring in the rules, you destroy the play, and it becomes something totally different. Anyway, that was just a thought that I had. I was watching all the hubbub and all the excitement about as we get close to the big NFL finale of the year of the Super Bowl and all the hype that goes with it. And I just had some thoughts I wanted to get out, you know. And I don't have anything against NFL football or any of the other sports. I'm not even opposed. You know, when my son was young, I, you know, went to all his football games. I had no problem with him as long as he chose. When he chose to play basketball, I went to the practices, I went to the games, and I supported him. But I never pushed him. And when he chose to leave basketball and play football, I did the same thing. I was at every one of his practices. I tried to get to every one of his games. I always tried to be there to support him, but I never pushed him. And one day, when he said, you know, I'm not going to play football anymore, I made sure and sat down and had a little talk with him and made sure that his logic and his reasoning were responsible. And then I agreed with him that if he didn't want to play, even here in the studio with sound buffeting material around me and all the effort that I've made to try to improve the sound quality in the studio in my office, you probably just heard there are ice trucks behind me in the distance trying to prepare the roads for the morning. But even here, I can't get away from the background noises. Maybe I'll be able to fade some of that out. Anyway, I was talking about my son and football. So when he decided that he no longer wanted to play football in high school, then I absolutely supported him on that. I didn't even for a moment try to talk him out of it. He decided that his guitar was more important than his football. And now, these years later, I think that's probably a pretty wise decision on his part. Because now, he still plays the guitar, and he may actually someday make a living doing that. But, in all honesty, pouring yourself and pouring your body and all the dedication and all the hard work it takes to play a major sport like that and then hope that you're going to actually be able to do it as an adult, that's, that's not wise for most people. For most people, that's just a path to destroy your body and crush your hopes when eventually it stops. So I think that was pretty wise on the part of my son. And now as he's grown and he's out on his own and he's, involved in a band and he's also supporting himself entirely with in his own home and with his own wages and all the things that he's doing, I look at him and I couldn't be more proud of him. But that's just a father bragging about his son. One of the things that I did want to talk about, though, in today's podcast, and this is not a very smooth transition, by the way. These thoughts are entirely unrelated, but I was thinking about the American settlers. And there's a good portion of Ohio that's relatively flat or just rolling hills. In the eastern portion of Ohio, there's some pretty serious hills. I'm not sure that there's anything you'd call a mountain in eastern Ohio. I don't know. Maybe residents in eastern Ohio will take issue with me on that. But I pretty much of everything that I've seen, and I've been pretty much all over Ohio, and there are some pretty big hills, but I don't see anything that I would really call a mountain in Ohio. So what I'm about to describe didn't really apply so much to Ohio, although there were, I'm sort of going backwards in this. I should have introduced the topic and then explained about about hills and valleys and mountains, but Anyway, what I'm talking about is the pioneers, the settlers, or whatever you want to call those people, who for one reason or another decided that where they lived at wasn't good enough, and so they got in their wagons and they headed west for whatever reason, and then they got to a certain area, and then for whatever reason they stopped. Now, in school, if we go to the government schools, you'll find a lot of different explanations for this behavior offered by the government schools. And the government teachers will tell you things, and Hollywood movies tell you things, and all this kind of, all this information comes at you, but it's pretty much all has a certain tilt to it. And so I wanted to just highlight a thought about what motivated people in the 1800s to leave eastern areas in North America and move towards western areas in North America. And this did happen in Canada to a certain extent, but far less. There was far less of the westward expansion in Canada than you saw in the U.S. And I wanted to touch on that because I think it's an interesting thought. And two people that I wanted to highlight as examples of what I think was the major motivation for people moving west. Now, there was, as an exception to what I'm about to present, there were gold rushes, and there was a couple silver rushes, and there was actually a lead rush, and there was a copper rush. And so opportunities like that, or the belief in an opportunity to get rich quick or whatever, those are the exceptions to the rules, because even though each of those rushes produced a surge of immigration westward, there was always, throughout the whole of the 1800s, a steady westward migration of people in the U.S., and I believe that the reason for that is what I'm about to present. Now, the two people I wanted to highlight in this were Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, both very well known, and both individuals, their stories have been greatly twisted by the state and by the media and by the entertainment industry and so forth to make them into cartoonish individuals that they, you know, cartoonish characters that they, that don't really represent what they were really like. Daniel Boone, of course, was a bit of an opportunist. He had been making a living by going on expeditions across through the Cumberland Gap and into Kentucky and hunting, trapping, hunting, the fur industry, essentially, and bringing back both fur and meat into Virginia for a living. And he was doing that, of course, because, you know, it's if you're not a landowner in the late 1700s in Virginia, if you're not a landowner or if you own very small amount of land, there wasn't a lot of opportunities for you other than, you know, working on a plantation for a landowner or working some type of really backbreaking labor of one kind or another to try to make a living. On the other hand, you could essentially just, you know, get your horses together or a couple mules in your horse or whatever you had and have enough basic equipment to camp, like we would call it camping today, except, you know, it was a bit more rustic, but not a whole lot. And you head out across the mountains, and within a few months, you could trap and hunt enough to make a decent living. Well, that's kind of appealing even to me today. If I could make a living doing that, work 3 or 4 months of the year, just out in the woods, me and 2 or 3 other guys, you know, hunting and trapping, and then come back and live in leisure for the rest of the year, that sounds very appealing. So that was Daniel Boone's original point in crossing through the Cumberland Gap and into Kentucky. As more and more of this took place, we're talking about the time right around the Revolutionary War, or the War of Independence, actually, is a more accurate way of describing it, because it really wasn't a revolution, it was a secession. But in spite of that, after the War of Independence, and once the Articles of Confederation were dumped and the Constitution was adopted, immediately the new federal government began putting restrictions on the day-to-day lives of regular people and making life uncomfortable on people living in the 13 new states. And now this is a story that you're not going to hear in, you know, in the mainstream media or in the movies in Hollywood or in what the government schools will teach you. But this caused a wave of migration westward, not just because there was free land available. There really wasn't free land available. What most people don't realize, like I was talking about Ohio a minute ago, a good portion of the usable land in Ohio in the late 1700s had already been, for lack of a better word, had been confiscated by Washington, by George Washington, and other groups of somewhat questionable surveyors, who had pretty much gobbled up all the good land in Ohio already, not long after the War of Independence. So to say that there was free land, let's say, in Ohio, is not really true. You had to buy your land from one of these, or make some kind of arrangement where you paid them some type of quit rent of some kind or whatever, some kind of arrangement like that. in order to get land in the newly opened Ohio Valley. So people moving into areas of Kentucky, and people moving out towards western Tennessee, and even people crossing the Mississippi River and moving into into Arkansas and those areas. This was not only was it not free, it was dangerous to do these things. So people were taking a great risk. And the motivating factor was to get away from the state. And my example of that, and if you just take Daniel Boone for an example, Daniel Boone sought to get away from the state. So he moved into central Kentucky. And in doing so, unfortunately, he sort of brought the state with him in doing that. And at the same time, in the years immediately after the War of Independence, the do-gooders decided to actually bring about a state in Kentucky. And so here he is, you know, he's moved to this place to try to get away from the state. And in doing so, the state followed him, and now the state's becoming everywhere he went. And Daniel Boone complained about this quite a bit. And he got to the point of where he actually was infuriated with the people around him in Kentucky. And he said, fine, you know what, I'm moving to Missouri. And he packed up everything and moved into the most remote areas he could, which was, at the time, Missouri. And he wasn't alone in doing that. There were a lot of people in the Appalachians, a lot of traditional Appalachian Scot-Irish folk that were just sick of the oppression of the government, of coming in and telling them where they could and couldn't grow their crops, what kind of crops they could and couldn't grow, and were trying to tax them on their products. And so, fine, you know, they'll just go to the Ozarks, leave the Appalachians and go to the Ozarks. And so even today, if you go to the Ozarks in Arkansas and Missouri, what you see is the descendants of those people who just could not tolerate the state in the Appalachians. And so they went forward to the very next place westward that's like Appalachia, and that's the Ozarks. Might even be argued that the Ozarks have slightly milder weather, at least compared to the northern Appalachians. The northern Appalachians get pretty cold. They have pretty harsh winters, whereas most of the Ozarks don't see that kind of snowfall and that kind of low temperatures. So, and then the other example is Davy Crockett. Davy Crockett, the story of Davy Crockett is horribly twisted by the state. I mean, here's a guy who, in his youth, he was, you know, just basically a mountain man. He liked to get out, and he liked to be free and just do what he wanted to do and not be restricted by anything. But the state slowly came into Tennessee and started taking over everything and just getting in his hair everywhere he went. Everything he tried to do, there's somebody passing a law against it. So Davy Crockett took a different path than Daniel Boone. Davy Crockett decided that what he would do to combat the state and the aggression of the state is to get involved and try to fix these crazy laws and fix this crazy government. And so he did. He got involved in government, and he got involved in the processes of the state. And he spent years trying to fix what he saw wrong with the government and what was wrong with the country. And this blaring thing that he saw as being the problem in America, he fought it and fought it and fought it. And when he finally got to the point where he realized he could fight the state no more, then he literally cursed Tennessee and said, I'm going to Texas. And off he went. And then, of course, he got down there and got himself involved in a war and got himself killed. But that's beside the point. The real thing we're looking at here is his motivations. And his motivation was in trying to get away from the state. I had to pause the microphone there because I still have the remnants of this flu hanging on. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice or not. But I decided to just go into a coughing fit there for a while. So I had to pause, and I'll try to pick things back up again. Now, part of the argument that the government schools and the Hollywood and these types, part of the argument that they want to tell you the reason that the westward expansion took place is because all the land was used up. Well, this is just a blatant lie. If you take Kentucky, for example, there were parts of Kentucky that were never settled. There were parts of Kentucky that right up until the time that the Parks Acts were being passed through Congress and land was being designated as public land and park public parks and things like this, right up to the time that that took place in the early 1900s, there were still parts of Kentucky that had not been homesteaded. I was mentioning this about Ohio a minute ago when I wasn't explaining what I was talking about. There were parts of southeastern Ohio that were never homesteaded, that were literally never homesteaded. And beautiful areas, by the way, that I've walked on perfectly acceptable areas, is as good a land as anything that I've seen in Missouri or Arkansas. And right there it is in southern Ohio, and it was never even homesteaded. So the state, when all these progressive laws started to take place in the early 1900s, they just confiscated all of it, called it public land, and made parks out of it. But that's the same in a lot of areas. You know, big portions of areas were not homesteaded, and the westward expansion passed right past them. And the difference being that the state was there. So, for instance, if you take Missouri as an example, large sections of Missouri were never homesteaded. But the state moved into Missouri, became an organized government using the violence of the state, and its very existence drove people on into other areas, into Kansas. And then, you know, Kansas was not even close to settled when the state moved in, and there were border wars, and there was all the agitation that came with the hate of the state, with the not hating the state, but the hate that the state brings. The state divides people and brings hate between them and causes these things. So as the state moved in with its laws and its all of its aggression, Kansas never even became close to settled before people started moving out, looking to go westward, trying to find a way to get where they could be free. You know, go on, look at Montana, look at Idaho, huge tracts of land that were never settled, and yet people passed right by them. And Idaho, what a beautiful place, Idaho. How could you pass through Idaho and not fall in love with it and want to stay your life right there in such a beautiful place? The further south you get into Nevada, and you start to understand why a lot of people didn't necessarily stop in Nevada. They went right on through to California. Nevada, without the modern conveniences of, you know, things like air conditioning and heating, without modern conveniences like that, and especially northern Nevada, might be a pretty rough place to try to homestead. But, of course, in modern days, it would be fine. But we don't have the chance because the state, and I did an article on this. Maybe the title of it will pop into my head, and maybe it won't, and maybe I'll put a link to it at some point in time. I did an article on how the state twisted the word homestead. When John Locke used the word homestead and when libertarians use the word homestead, we have one meaning for it. But the state, starting right after John Locke used the phrase, the state began twisting the phrase to mean something different. So John Locke, when he was talking about homestead, he was talking about taking resources, or specifically land, but it can apply to any resources, taking land that doesn't currently belong to anyone, or that no one has any signs that they're using it, or it's been abandoned, or whatever. Taking that land and improving upon the land. Now, this might mean planting a garden. It might mean planting a vineyard or an orchard, or it might mean building a building, or it might mean putting up fences and designating that land as your own. One way or the other, Locke saw the act of improving the land or the act of mixing your labor with that good as being an act of homesteading. Now, almost immediately, the state jumped on this and knew that the logic behind this was so clear that the state would never be able to contradict this. And if this idea got out of control, it could really threaten the power of the state. So the state started using the word homestead, but it used it differently. All you had to do in the late 1700s, or actually even back earlier in the mid-1700s, all you had to do to homestead in the eyes of the state was to survey. Now, that's a lot different than actually improving the property. You go out to survey it in the mid-1700s, all you're doing is writing down some numbers and scratching on some paper, maybe making a little map and writing some descriptions. But you're not actually doing anything to the land. How can that be homesteading when all you're doing is scratching on a paper? How can scratching on a paper give you the right to own and sell the land? But that's what the state did in the 1700s. And when the newly formed United States was born, and the state there immediately adopted that standard, so that all a person had to do was scratch on a paper, and you had homesteaded, and you could now sell that land to someone else. Now, it is convenient, I suppose, if you're someone like George Washington, who did that for a living, who surveyed for a living, and who had gone out and surveyed vast tracts of land that he had never improved in the slightest, but using simply his surveying, or even hiring other people to survey on your behalf, to do that, and then sell that land, like if you had homesteaded it. Of course, the newly formed government of the colonies that became the United States, of course they adopted that standard, considering that Washington made his living that way. That, in addition to his brewing of alcohol for his whiskey business, but then again, talking about taxing whiskey would take us into another direction, and I would go off on another rant. So the state took this word, homesteading, and it applied a whole new meaning to it. All you have to do is survey it. And then, as I've said this before, it was, and specifically in the article I referenced to a moment ago, so when that great champion of liberty, Thomas Jefferson, became president, and then in desperation, the French government, specifically the Napoleon government, Napoleon needed cash so that he could continue, murdering and rampaging across Europe. So he had all this land over in the New World that wasn't doing him any good. So he makes an arrangement to sell the land for cash to the Jefferson administration. And the Jefferson administration then openly violates the Constitution and bought the Louisiana Purchase. Now, let's get to, do you grade the end result of something? Do you grade its morality based on the end result? In other words, let's say I see an old lady at the ATM and she's withdrawing money from the ATM, and that's ATM being an automatic teller machine that we have here in the U.S. I don't know what they call them overseas, but basically it coughs up money when you slide your little card in it. So you see an old lady at the ATM, and you run up to her right as she's getting her cash out of the ATM, and you bap her in the head, and you grab her cash. And then you run away, and you go, and you buy nice things for poor people. So does the buying nice things for poor people justify the fact that you robbed the old lady? Well, most moral people would say, no, that's crazy. What are you talking about? Well, that's because the ends can never justify the means. If the means are immoral, then it doesn't matter what the end result is. The fact is you have behaved immorally. And that really is the difference between the libertarian point of view on the zero aggression principle and everybody else. Everybody else looks to the ends to provide the morals for their behavior. Well, so if we look at the Louisiana Purchase and we say, yeah, but that worked out great. So you're using the ends to justify the means. You're saying it's fine to bash the old lady in the head as long as you do something noble with the money. Well, isn't that very leftist of you? No, the Louisiana Purchase was entirely illegitimate for a number of reasons. First off, Napoleon sold land to Jefferson that Napoleon didn't necessarily have any rights to sell. A good portion of what was called the Louisiana Purchase, Spain believed it owned. Part of it, Great Britain believed it owned. And part of what, Jefferson very quickly and almost in desperation throws together a surveying party. And he tells these guys, get to the West Coast as quickly as possible and survey and map and record your activities as you go. And this will cause legitimate ownership to be recognized in the hands of the United States. You see what he's doing there? He's homesteading on behalf of a government. Now, that's a radical departure from Locke's original concept of homesteading. And it's even a radical departure from what the Crown had twisted Locke's homesteading to mean in the 1700s. So Jefferson, that Tower of Liberty, that guy that we all want to hold up as our favorite, old-time libertarian, Jefferson violated the Constitution, and then Jefferson sent these guys, the Lewis and Clark expedition, and they go across the West, basically aggressing upon the territory of a number of people who were already fully occupying and owning that property. But even in addition, even if somehow in your mind you don't recognize that the Native Americans that were there already owned that property, even if you don't accept that clear logic fact, and you think that some government in France owned that property, and the French who had never even been there somehow owned it, even if you believe that, they left the actual land of the Louisiana Purchase and marched across areas that weren't even involved in the Louisiana Purchase and took possession all the way to the Pacific Ocean. This included land that Russia had already established rights on. Russia had already put settlements up and down through that area and was actively fishing and utilizing the coast that the United States then confiscated through this act. And keep in mind that what this really was doing, what this Louisiana Purchase and what this Lewis and Clark expedition, as they moved across, built forts, and did all the things that they were doing in order to show land ownership, they were for the first time indicating that the state owned real property without a head of state. Now, of course, we have a president in the United States, but he's not the head of state in the sense that a king is the head of state. In the past, the land that the government owned was actually the possession of a person, the king, or at least the royal family, and it would be split up between them as they needed to or as they fought among themselves or whatever. But a human being, prior to the Louisiana Purchase, a human being owned land, not the state. The state didn't own any land. It was the head of state that owned the land. But when the United States purchased the Louisiana Purchase and then sent Lewis and Clark across open land to show ownership of it, for the very first time in history, a non-human entity, an entity that simply exists because we agree that it exists, now took the embodiment of a human in its ability to own something, to own land. That it's a radical departure from everything that John Locke talked about. It's a radical departure from anything that had ever happened in history, and Jefferson did that. Now, like everything the state does, there's always a cascading effect. And even if one or two things are good, or even if the initial result of the action of the state is good, the end result will always produce more bad than whatever good that it produced. So in the case of the Louisiana Purchase, it seems like it's good to open up all that land and get it into the hands of a country like the United States rather than a completely tyrannical country like France was. However, by twisting the standard of what was homesteading, what actually took place was it allowed the federal government in Washington, D.C. to grab land. And so they began. And yes, there was a westward expansion of European settlers of European descent moving out west. That took place. And as I said, it was mostly because they were trying to escape the rules and the constant regulations and the constant nanny state that was developing in the east. And so they moved west to get away from that. But as they did so, and as the land became more and more scarce, the reason it became more scarce is because the federal government started swallowing it all up. And in the other article, I'll try to remember to put a link to this article I keep referring to. I go into the details of which specific legal acts that the government of the United States did in order to try to twist the homesteading and try to get control of it. But eventually it ended up with the progressives around 1900 when they began designating certain areas as permanently unsettleable, as permanently the possessions of the federal government, that when this took place, and of course we all applaud Teddy Roosevelt, oh, he created the park system, oh, what a wonderful thing. No, what he did was he codified the behavior of the state in stealing and possessing land that had never been a legitimate aspect of the state prior to that time. That's what Teddy Roosevelt did. And that created a situation where now we have vast tracts of land that belong to a non-human entity. And we accept that with commonness. We accept that a non-human can own land. And of course, this opens the floodgates for corporations to own things and corporations to even exist. How can a corporation exist without certain human-like rights? And of course, it can't. And the Supreme Court has already made several decisions indicating that corporations have certain human-like characteristics. And as corporations are treated like humans, and as the state is treated like a human, we actually have this mythical creature that never had rights before. Suddenly, we believe it has rights. Now, this brings me to another thought, and I hope I can get this one squeezed in without going off on a rant and taking away too much time. There have been a number of people, and I face this every now and then, it happens, but I should be used to it by this time. But there have been a number of people recently that have referred to me and my podcasts as being, pessimistic or defeatist, because I say things like, the state is going to expand, the state is going to do these things, the state is going to shut down the internet, the state is going to dominate the internet, the state is going to take these rights away. And I say these things not because I'm a defeatist or not because I'm a pessimist or not because I think the state's going to win and I think we have no hope and things like that. No, actually, let me think of something. Okay, let's do it this way. This is a lesson I used to teach my kids when they were little. I would say to them, now listen, duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, what comes next? And even the smallest child can catch on to this game, and they understand it, and they figure it out. You know, if it goes duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, goose, then when you hear duck, duck, goose comes next, it's not that hard to figure out. Watching the state is the same way. The state always behaves in a certain way. The cycles of the state always repeat. The only change the state ever makes is that it always gets bigger and it always gets stronger and it always seeks more victims to dominate and more wealth to steal and more wealth to destroy. It constantly seeks more and more, like a great dragon going about seeking whom it may devour. That's what the state always has done and always will do as long as the state exists. So to have the, what I believe to be a naive approach that somehow the state is going to not behave the same way that it's always behaved, you know, that's not being optimistic. That's being silly. To assume the state has always done certain things, but somehow will not do those things the next time, duck, duck, goose. It's always going to be duck, duck, goose. It's never going to be duck, duck, lizard. There is no duck, duck, lizard. There's only duck, duck, goose. Duck, duck, goose. The state will always behave in a predictable fashion. So then you look at the internet and you see the freedom on the internet and you see how information is getting from private people to private people, and thoughts like the ones you're hearing me say right now are going straight from me to you, and the government is helpless to do anything about it. And that just grinds on the state. Notice the difference there, government to state? Some of my listeners are still confused about this. I need to do a whole episode just on the difference between the government and the state. Those people working around doing stuff, that's the government. But the state is the bigger entity that exists because we believe in it. So the government is helpless to control the internet. And they start to pass a law. Oh, we'll pass a law and we'll get control of the internet. And so people on the internet kind of freak out. And for a very short period of time, people on the internet don't tolerate this government intrusion. And so the government backs down and everybody on the internet says, see, we have the power. But the state just rubs its claws together and goes, really? And then the state will shut the internet down, or the state will regulate it to the point of where it will not be what it is, and where voices like mine will not be heard. And if you don't think that's true, how many people in China are saying what I'm saying? It's coming, folks. It's not pessimism on my part. It's reality. It's looking ahead. It's seeing the pattern that has always been taken, and it's expecting that pattern. And it's saying, and my point of view is saying, expect this. And if you expect it, you'll prepare for it. And if you're prepared for it, when it gets here, we just step to the side and go around it. Once again, I'll use Penn Jillette and his example about atheism and Christianity. He says, Penn is an atheist, and he says, even as an atheist, if I'm standing in the street and you believe a bus is about to hit me, and I don't believe there's a bus, I would want you to pull me out of the way to keep me from getting hit by the bus, even if I don't believe in the bus. You see, it's on the way. And if we make no preparations for it whatsoever, we just stand there denying it, we're going to get hit by the bus. But if you make preparations and you realize the possibility of the bus, when the bus gets there, you can simply step to the side or you get hit. Now, the state, through the arm of the government, through the media, through corporations, through every means that the state has at its disposal, the state will stop all this crazy freedom of speech that's all over the internet. The state will stop it. What we have to do is understand that bus is coming and make preparations so that we can just sidestep it when it happens. And we'll have the secondary, whatever that is. And, if I sat and brainstormed for a while with some people, we could probably come up with 15 or 20 options. But we have to do that. We have to figure this out. And we can't do it openly. We have to figure it out among ourselves so that when the time comes that the internet switch gets flipped, we just sidestep it and continue. And we have to have communication between us, and we have to be able to get our message out. And we can do that if we prepare ahead of time. Okay, folks, I'm hitting real close to my my stopping point here and running out of time, so I want to just wrap this up. Thank you very much for your patience and waiting for me to come back to podcasting again. It's been a long week. It's been a long month. It's been a long 3 months that we've dealt with the illness in the family and the death in the family and all the pain that goes with it. And thank you to all of you who stuck with me and just kept coming back to the website and kept downloading the stuff. I really appreciate that. Also, to all the people who have donated to badquaker.com, there's some background noise for you. To all the people who have donated to badquaker.com to keep us on the air for another year, I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. I'm very uncomfortable talking about those things, so I do appreciate it. And once again, to Bob Higgs, thank you. Thank you very much. And as my voice is running out, and as I always like to say, for more... For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com, and hopefully tomorrow my voice will be better. Thanks a lot, folks. Thanks.